Welcome to Media Law and Ethics, a podcast series from the School of Communication at Radford University. I'm Professor Bill Kovarik, and I'm serving as your guide through this course. This is the seventh in our podcast series out of 10 for the course. Today we're discussing broadcasting, and we'll begin with a story that illustrates just how complex broadcast law can be. In 1996 and 1997, Jane Aker and her husband Steve Wilson investigated the use of synthetic growth hormones, BGH, in Florida dairies. They found that the hormone probably had dangerous side effects, which is why it was banned in Canada and several European countries. When their report was completed, they also found that their TV station, Fox affiliate WTVT, was under heavy legal pressure from hormone manufacturer Monsanto Corporation. Rather than airing a program that balanced public health concerns against the industry's position, Monsanto lawyers told Fox management that they would sue if any program was run, any program at all. Eventually, after a considerable amount of argument, Aker and Wilson were fired by the managers of WTVT. So they sued WTVT, and they won in August of 2000 in a state court in Florida, claiming that the TV station had fired them after they threatened to tell the FCC that it had tried to distort the news. The Florida whistleblower law allows an employee to recover damages when an employer retaliates against the efforts to report unlawful behavior. But a federal appeals court overturned the ruling on a technicality and basically said that the FCC had ruled against distortions in other cases, but regulatory hearings were not the same as law. So it's a narrow technicality. And meanwhile, Aker and Wilson, incidentally, were awarded the Society of Professional Journalists Ethics in Journalism Award and the Goldman Environmental Prize. So what is it that made this such a strange and difficult case? First of all, who has the First Amendment right here? The reporters or the TV station? And who decides? The courts? The Federal Communications Commission? The state courts? And then secondly, what is news distortion? The FCC says they often receive complaints concerning broadcast journalism, inaccuracy or one-sided news reports, or inadequate coverage of stories, and they don't intervene because First Amendment forbids them from replacing the journalistic judgment of licensees, that is, the station management, with their own. However, and here's the catch, as public trustees, broadcast licensees may not intentionally distort the news. So there is a rule, or there isn't a rule. Okay. So the commission will investigate a station for news distortion if it receives documented evidence of rigging or slanting, and of particular concern, according to the FCC's own website, of particular concern would be evidence of the direction to employees from station management to falsify the news. That's exactly what Aker and Wilson said was going on. So what is the deal here? What is really happening? The problem is that, first of all, it's hard to believe that the FCC news distortion rule really means anything at all. And that's part of the problem dealing with broadcast law. Sometimes it means what it says, sometimes it doesn't, and it's always in flux. One reason that it's harder to regulate or to interpret regulations for radio and television is that both are considered to be regulated media, unlike print, film, and web, which are protected media. Regulation of technology, structure, and content of broadcasting comes through Congress to the Federal Communications Commission, which then writes regulations. So the first and most important form of control is through licensing of broadcast stations through the FCC. Stations that don't abide by a host of regulations could theoretically lose their broadcast licenses, although this is extremely rare and it's only happened in a very few cases in history. The main trend is towards deregulation, especially since the 1980s. And yet, in the summer of 2003, when the FCC tried to further loosen ownership regulations, the move proved extremely controversial and was subsequently challenged in court, and the deregulation process stalled and was subsequently stalled by Congress. So there is, it's difficult to keep track of these things. We know how it all started, at least we might as well begin there. In 1912, the Radio Act required all ships to have radio telegraph operators on duty 24 hours a day, and it also licensed ship and shore stations. It prevented the Marconi Company from controlling activities of people who used its equipment, which, of course, the company had been forcing operators to refuse communication with, to those using other equipment. So they stopped that. And that's what happened on the Titanic, in part. The Marconi operators forced the other operators off the air at a very inopportune moment. And the Radio Act of 1912 was, in part, a reaction to the Titanic. Radio communication was in its infancy when it was shut down right before World War I, or during World War I, by the government. And at that point, the Radio Corporation of America was formed out of American Marconi, which, of course, was actually a British-owned company. So RCA and Westinghouse get together, and they form the National Broadcasting Corporation in order to take advantage of radio. As they do this and other radio broadcasters get involved in the post-World War I 1920s enthusiasm for radio, there's a lot of conflict over the air. And there is at first an attempt by Commerce Secretary Herbert Hoover to set up a voluntary regulatory system. It doesn't really work. So in 1927, the Congress passes the Radio Act of 1927, which sets up licensing and frequency allocation systems for commercial stations. The rationale for regulation was the scarcity of available frequencies, and the broadcasters were said to be operating in the public interest, convenience, and necessity, which meant that their licenses were given to them by the American people, and their licenses could be taken away again. The FRC, Federal Radio Commission, became the FCC through the Communications Act of 1934, which was a broader regulatory scheme that included wireless, mass media, common carrier, field operations, and many other things, along with just straight-up broadcasting. There wasn't really a whole lot of change in the basic legislation until about 1996, when the Communications Act of 1996 was passed, which led to a major reorganization and deregulation of the media marketplace. It's led to many mergers, it's reduced distinctions between common carriers and mass media, it required the V-chip to filter violent programming, or to allow parents to program violence on new TV sets. The Communications Decency Act was part of this and was struck down in Reno versus ACLU, which is something we'll pick up in the obscenity area. And then the switch to digital television was also ordered as part of this in 2009. So basically, the Radio Act of 1912, the Radio Act of 1927, the FCC Act of 1934, and the Communications Act of 1996 are your major landmarks of legislation. And all of them are mostly built to control the structure of the broadcasting industry rather than the content. Let's talk about a couple of interesting licensing cases. Trinity Methodist Church versus the Federal Radio Commission, 1933, involved a Los Angeles church that had a radio license, and it claimed a First Amendment interest in maintaining it. And the U.S. Supreme Court said that radio licenses were regulated by the FRC, which became the FCC, of course, and upheld what was in effect a prior restraint. Now, notice the contrast between this and the Near versus Minnesota case the year before. That was the one where they said the state of Minnesota couldn't close down a nuisance newspaper. There were similar sorts of prior restraint cases. So, in effect, prior restraint is allowable on the broadcast level, but not allowable in print. There were a couple of others. One of the most interesting of the licensing cases was the Office of Communication of the United Church of Christ versus the FCC. Now, the church sued to get standing in order to be able to appeal a license. But the real background of the case is that during the Civil Rights Movement in the 1950s and 60s, a considerable amount of controversy rose over the refusal of TV stations to cover news about the Civil Rights Movement. there would be times when national news would be blacked out with little signs that said, sorry, cable trouble. Or there were instances that were well documented and complained about where there'd be programs in which white elected officials discussed the Little Rock crisis and the need to maintain segregation, but when others like Medgar Evers, who was then the field secretary of the NAACP in Mississippi, asked for time to present a different viewpoint, they would be denied. And this just happened over and over and over again. So the standing that the United Church of Christ was able to get in this case gave them the power to challenge the license. The license was challenged, and it was denied. And it was one of the few times when that ever happened in licensing, for any content reasons. When we talk about content regulation cases in broadcasting, there's really two big things that come up all the time. One of them is the Equal Time Rule, Section 315, and the other one is the Fairness Doctrine. So let's start with the Equal Time Rule. This began in 1934, regulated campaign advertising in politics, and it basically said that if a station sells advertising to one candidate, they have to sell the same advertising to the other candidate. So it's equal time. Doesn't apply to news programs or talk shows, but it does apply to advertising, and it's still in effect. So it's a advertising has to be carried is the rule. But now what happens if a station carries advertising and the advertising is libelous and there's a lawsuit? Are they responsible? In a 1959 case, Farmers Educational Cooperative Union versus WDAY, the broadcasters had to air a candidate's remarks. The candidate was basically called a communist, and he was associated with a cooperative, with a farmer's cooperative, you know, which of course is very, very sinister, obviously, all that grain stacked up in those silos, right? And anyway, the broadcaster in this case was granted absolute immunity from a libel suit under the circumstances. There are many other similar sorts of cases that more or less prove the point that the broadcasters are harmless and become more or less like common carriers during the exact time of the political campaign. However, outside of the time of the political campaign, they don't have to carry advertising. That was the case in the CBS versus FCC 1981 case. Now, the Fairness Doctrine is something else, and it's really complicated. It was established in 1947. It's been mostly abolished since 1987. There are some exceptions that don't really count, like the personal attack rule and the political editorializing rule. And there are some movements afoot to kind of bring back the Fairness Doctrine for broadcasting. It's hard to keep track of the whole thing, but we'll just try to give you the outline here. The point in 1947 was to ensure that both sides of controversial issues outside of political campaigns, so this is not about political campaigns, it's about issues. And the idea is to present both sides. Well, what if there's more than both sides? What if there's a whole lot of sides? What if the TV station is unfair, like the one in Jackson, Mississippi was? What if all kinds of things? And it's very complicated to try to enforce this sort of rule. So it was mostly abolished in 1987 in the deregulatory era. But there are liberals like Robert F. Kennedy and some others who believe very strongly in it, that there ought to be some sort of litmus test for accuracy or better service to people. Kennedy says, for example, today, as a result of the abolishment of the Fairness Doctrine, six giant multinational corporations now control all 14,000 radio stations in our country, almost all 6,000 TV stations, 80% of the newspapers, all of our billboards, and now most of the internet information services. So you have six guys who dictate what Americans have as information and what we see as news. The news departments have become corporate profit centers. They no longer have any obligation to benefit the public interest. And so bring back the Fairness Doctrine is the bottom line. Well, I see the complaint, is the remedy the appropriate remedy for the complaint, even if you agree that that's an accurate complaint, which might be a little overstated, I think. But what is the remedy? And so that's an open question, something that courts are wrestling with, something that everybody in media policy area is wrestling with. In terms of content regulation, also there's indecency and obscenity cases. We're going to take those up mostly later on, but one of these is FCC versus Pacifica Foundation of 1978, in which mild sanctions are upheld by the courts against a radio network that aired George Carlin's Seven Dirty Words comic monologue. The main upshot of the Pacifica case was something called a safe harbor for indecent programming that would go from 10 p.m. to 6 a.m. So this is just for over-the-air broadcasting, and basically less decent or somewhat more offensive adult programming could begin at 10 o'clock at night, and otherwise earlier programming was supposed to be more family-oriented. Books have been written about the controversy over the Pacifica case and the subsequent cases that came up, including Action for Children's TV versus FCC. In 2001, at a time of the ascendancy of the Bush administration and conservative points of view about broadcasting, the FCC issued regulations on indecency and obscenity, and they're linked at the website. They're long and they're very, very descriptive, and some of them are even sort of funny. But what it led to was, by the year 2004, there were lots of fines, 12 major violations, $8 million in fines coming in, and a lot of political pressure to remove indecency from the airwaves. And this continued despite a number of what were being called incidental indecency or incidental fleeting expletives. And in July of 2010, a federal appeals court said that the FCC's rules on indecency were too vague and they violated the First Amendment, and that fleeting expletives or wardrobe failures shouldn't lead to massive multi-million dollar fines. Now, what this all means over the long run is that the networks are going to be a little bit freer to have the kind of programming that is like cable TV, and people in the social conservative movement are going to be a little bit more uncomfortable what they see over broadcast TV. But essentially nothing much is going to change precipitously. Now, there's other rather smaller content regulation areas. One that's really worth pointing out is the hoax rule. FCC regulations ban broadcast fabrications about disasters or catastrophes. The idea is to minimize panic and to avoid harm, and yet it's also true that there isn't anything like a hoax rule imposed on the print media. And imagine banning print tabloids from fabrications. And it just goes to show how much content regulation is really underlying the entire broadcasting system. In addition to content regulation, there is structural regulation, and this is really the part where there's lots and lots of controversy. So in terms of structural regulation, we think about ownership issues, we think about antitrust issues, and we think about long-term public service issues in broadcasting. So, just very quickly, in terms of ownership, originally it was not possible to own more than 7 TV stations, 7 AM stations, and 7 FM radio stations. The law was liberalized in 1984, and then in 1986 there was a complete realignment of ownership, and there was no limit to the number of radio and TV stations one company could own, but owners were not supposed to reach more than 35% of all audiences. So what this meant was that, in effect, one company could own every radio station on your FM dial as you drove through a particular part of the world. And that now, today, most radio is actually owned by a very small number of companies. So even though a lot of ownership regulation was thrown out the window with the Federal Communications Act of 1996, one thing that was retained was the prohibition against cross-ownership, that is, a newspaper and a TV station in the same market, owned by the same company. That is considered to be too much concentrated media power in one place. A proposal to allow that, to deregulate that sort of limitation, was advanced in June of 2003, and it was defeated in a storm of controversy, along with a number of other liberalizations of ownership rules. So right now we're kind of in limbo when it comes to ownership regulation, kind of having stalled in the great deregulatory process, but no true policy direction emerging since. A number of people, it's worth pointing out, would like to own low-power TV and radio stations and cannot get licenses from the FCC and have tried to get licenses, even though it's possible now to do this, try to get licenses since the 1990s. And they're not issuing licenses at this point because they don't have an overarching theory of where radio and TV should go. No discussion about the control of the structure or the regulation of the structure of broadcasting is complete without some nod to antitrust theory in law. And let me just very briefly outline that. There's really two types of monopolies. So a trust or a monopoly can be horizontally integrated. So one company might own, for instance, all of the oil refineries in the country. Or it could be vertically integrated. A company could own everything from the oil wells up through the pipelines, the oil refineries, the marketing middle stations, and of course the final point of sale. That would be vertical integration. Okay, so when there's an oligopoly, a small number of firms control a market both through horizontal and vertical integration interlocking. And as the mass media has become larger, and as mergers have taken place more and more, in part as a substitute for innovation, I have to say, because this was the big strategy for convergence, let's just get bigger, then as a result, you have a far more concentrated media market with lots and lots of competition springing up from very small competitors off on the side in the web and internet. Now, the classical antitrust view, or the, let's say, traditional liberal antitrust view on philosophy, is that any market dominance by itself is evidence of anti-competitive behavior. So that's the per se philosophy. There's a neo-conservative point of view, which is the rule of reason, that some restraints are pro-competitive and ought to be encouraged, but some restraints are not and should be discouraged. So if newspapers or radio stations are failing financially, then joint operating agreements or mergers could be seen as pro-competitive, as they allow the newspapers or radio stations to struggle to compete with other media. So that's a rule of reason approach. Now, it's not possible in this time and space to go into this very differently, but it is important to note that the courts have consistently tried to hold the media to the same sorts of business standards as other businesses, so that, for example, in Associated Press versus NLRB of 1937, AP couldn't fire employees for organizing unions, even though they tried to. They also tried to hide behind the First Amendment. Hey, you can't tell us what to do. We're the AP. And the court said, no, you're a business first. Same thing in AP versus United States in 1945, when AP put up barriers to entry. The Justice Department asked that they be kept down. In U.S. versus Paramount Pictures in 1948, there was a similar case that involved movie studios who were forced, like Warner Brothers movie studios were forced, to take block bookings in order to satisfy the financial needs of the big studios. And the theater owners didn't really like it, and they asked for relief from the government, and the U.S. sued Paramount and others, and the Supreme Court agreed that the vertical integration of the theater and movie industry had to be broken up. There was a case that involved a radio station and a newspaper called the Lorraine Journal versus U.S. Company in 1951. The newspaper, Lorraine Journal, refused to accept advertising from anybody that also bought ads on a radio station. This is a classic refusal-to-deal sort of approach to business, and it's illegal, and it's one of the primary issues involved in the U.S. versus Microsoft case of 1998, which was settled around 2001 and continued in Europe for another couple of years after that. Basically, a U.S. District Court of Appeals ruled that Microsoft had an illegal monopoly on operating systems, among other things. But when you consider, that's really a kind of a per se rule. I mean, in other words, there's an enormous market domination by Microsoft here, but there's not an enormous market for competing operating systems. There's Apple and there's Linux, and people are free to go to those, but most people in the 90% range want to use the same kind of operating system that everybody else is using because they want a stable platform. So the rule of reason would say that this should be permissible to a certain extent. As we wrap up this section on broadcasting, you have to admit that we have gone fast and skimmed a lot, and there is a lot more to this, but let me just repeat some of the very key points I've been trying to make in this podcast. Overall, you should know about legislation in 1912, 1927, 1934, and 1996. You should know the difference between Section 315 and the Fairness Doctrine. You should know about the hoax rule, the news distortion rule, the rule of sevens, and the cross-ownership rule. And there's a couple of key cases, especially Trinity, Farmers Co-op, United Church of Christ, and Pacifica in particular. So, with that, we'll wrap up broadcasting for now, and we'll move on to some other areas. Thank you very much.